All right, make sure you're in fellowship as we are here finishing up chapter 13. And to conclude our analysis of this particular chapter, there's some observations, final observations that we can make in regards to the chapter overall. And that's where we left off, point 36, page 18 of our notes. Under some concluding observations. First of all, separation is a central theme of this section, here revolving around Abraham and Lot. B, it is the final application of separation necessary for Abraham to fulfill the conditions of the covenant, as we have been bringing out in chapter 12:1, the initial disclosure of the covenant. Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. He's done all of that except for the portion of separating from his family. So, now in this regard, it may be that Lot was originally regarded by Abram as his heir. Earlier, we were told that in chapter 11, that Sarai was barren, couldn't have kids in that regard. Verse 30, chapter 11, Sarah was barren, she had no children. So this would obviously, again, on the physical realm, in regards to Abraham, God's Yahweh's promise of making him a great nation, that he would need an heir in order for this to occur. And if they couldn't have children, then maybe Lot, his nephew, who would legitimately be next in line in regards to associations, would be that heir. So that's not completely out of the picture that Abraham may have thought along those fashions. And one reason why he took as long as he did to separate from Lot. But as the case may be, we do know that Abram, to begin with, was not on top of his game spiritually. Initially, in regards to meeting these covenants, and that is brought out through the situation of which he temporarily left God's geographical will and went to Egypt. But after that, it then became a different story. After the Egyptian debacle, Genesis 12, Abram becomes reoriented to God's plan, and now he is seeing things differently. He's starting to see things differently. Rebound, prayer, reorientation, reestablishment of, if you will, his NPR. In that regards, he becomes reoriented and has a different perception in regards to the applications at hand and God's promises. So he, in that vein then, developments occur, providing an opportunity for Abram to make the application of separation via conflict between Abram's herdsmen and Lot's herdsmen, as brought out in verses 5 through 7. And that illustrates, obviously, the conflict of the angelic conflict as it revolves around positive and negative volition. And again, we're not dealing with an unbeliever with Lot. We're dealing with a believer. And volition is that finally divided in regards to God's perception and what he accepts versus what he doesn't accept. So what was true spiritually in that case was evidenced physically between the two, that is, conflict existed. And often that is what happens when you have spiritual conflict, physical conflict will follow. So Abram, then in grace and faith rest, pursues peace between the parties while restoring peace with God via the application of separation. That's verses 8 and 9. That's what that emphasized. As he extended grace, first choice to Lot for which real estate he wanted, but was insistent in regards to the separation to occur. You got your life. You want to make your choices. That's fine. Nobody's going to stand in your way. If anybody gets in your way, let it be God. And make your choices. But we are not spiritually compatible in this respect. Your interests are not my interests. Abraham, obviously, in thinking in regards to Lot. Lot had no interest in God's plan, and he evidenced it by the choice he made as he was contested by Abram in that regards. And in so doing, Abram, in application, then obviously had removed any potential hostility or animosity on God's part directed towards him and reestablished his peace. One of the things that you can read this verse probably 1,000 times to people, people that are not gapping it, don't take doctrine seriously along this line, truly fail to miss the implications and ramifications of the verse, and that's James 4:4, that when you pursue and embrace the cosmos as your close associates, friends in life, whom you call your friends, you put yourself on the opposing side of God to try to embrace the world. You are engaging, if you will, in an act of spiritual infidelity, just as Abram was being not spiritually obedient in orientation to God's will for not separating from Lot. So, you adulteresses, James 4:4, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? The world in its capacity, but here with emphasis on negative volition. Again, it doesn't remove our obligations, responsibility of the witness that we've got to be in the world. Situations demand sometimes our company in regards to people. We recognize all that. But these are not the ones who are what you embrace, who you embrace and pursue in regards to the real and close associations that you have in life. Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of the God. That's pretty hardcore. They can call you a separatist if they want, because you don't want to hang with them. Peter said, don't be surprised when they do that. They name call and all these other things because you take your stand for doctrine, etc. But the matter of fact is, positive volition would rather have the whole world mad at them than have God mad at them. And considering the fact that God's not limited in regards to blessing, obviously he's not limited in regards to how he may want to pour his wrath on people either. All these things we take in consideration and conclude in regards to sound logic with respect to applications and why we make these applications, etc. So when he finally made the application, obviously with every application that he made, you see this advance, this progress, and opening up of these blessings poured upon Abram. And here he obviously has restored harmony with God in his determination. Obviously, we can probably conclude safely that he recognized when he got back from Egypt, all right, I've got to make this application. All this comes about in the scenario of going back to the altar and praying and calling on God's name, etc. All right, I've got to make this application. And it comes about and God provides the circumstance and situation. See, for it to happen. Again, sometimes it does happen naturally. Probably more often than not. But there are still occasions, and the test will be on believers, that we have to make the stand, and we have to say no more. I like you. I have nothing against you. I love you, whether you're a family member or a friend, past friend or whatever. But look, we got different lives. And no, I'm not going to hang out with you on vacations and embrace you as my close friend and associate from now on out. I have other family members called the royal family, and those who are positive to doctrine, et cetera, et cetera. See, again, just because you happen to see people, get together with them, family or whatever on occasion, isn't violating this doctrine. There's that balance. We recognize that. It's in your attitude mostly, and the willingness to not let these things interfere with your own spiritual advance and NPR or otherwise. And not give the appearance that's what you're pursuing and chasing. See. But anyway, believers can figure it out for themselves just like the rest of us have. H. Abram's application, when he made that application, was greatly rewarded. Again, just one of those things. I've read through this passage I don't know how many times in my life. Not until I went through it word for word and verse by verse like this have I seen really the real ramifications and implications that are involved in regards to the Abrahamic covenant and Abraham's application otherwise in that respect under the terms of separation. And Abraham's blessing, if you will, was multiplied each time in regards to God's promises to him. And it doesn't, you know, all these blessings don't come overnight. Some you will wait until phase 3. Abraham had to wait until phase 3. New Testament Hebrews tells us that he was looking to the new city, the new Jerusalem. And that's where he had his eyes. See, all this shows his focus, etc. And as things may happen in time, etc., phase 2 blessing, and there's that too. You know, it occurs. So, you can either have your sacred cow and worship it, or you can worship God. And then you're left with what one is able to do for you, either way. All right, the evidence of Lot's spiritual degeneracy in regards to the reason why he was under separation mandate by God is seen in his choice of real estate and company. That was verses 10 through 13. Picking the area of Jordan, in spite of the fact that it was probably common news and information around there that the people inhabited, particularly the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, were extremely wicked. They obviously were heavily involved in abnormal vices under the STA. Abnormal sexual vices called homosexuality. One that always gets me is these liberals constantly screaming that homosexuality had, Sodom and Gomorrah had nothing to do with homosexuality. Oh, really? Have you ever read the dictionary? Where did the word sodomite come from? It comes from the Bible. People have recognized it over all the centuries, see. But anyway, there you go. Pay homage to your new leader. Call him Alex for short if he's a friend of yours. Jay, now the real estate, so the evidence of his degeneracy is seen in the company that he embraces and what he pursues, abandoning God's will otherwise in regards to his life. Now, we all live in an evil world. It's not so much the geography and that aspect of it, but it's the fact that he dismisses God's will for his life otherwise. And he turns and he embraces the world as a replacement in this fashion. So J, the real estate was destined for judgment, and his associates for spiritual degenerates, to put it mildly. So again, things often are not what they may physically appear to be. God knows. Okay, Lot unwittingly, obviously, when you're a reversionist under negative volition, running under your SCA and human viewpoint, you're not in tune and aware often of your the ramifications of your misapplications in their fullest of sense. And as it would be with Lot, he unwittingly becomes a victim of the, quote, "the one who disdains you, I will curse," end quote. The fact that while he may have embraced Abram as a relative, as his uncle, what he could do for him monetarily, by association, spiritually, he had real no respect for him. That was part of the covenant promise in regards to Abram. The one who curses you, I will curse. Curse doesn't mean necessarily that you engage in a venomous verbal assault in regards to someone simply by dismissing them, one who is positive, standing for the truth otherwise, dismissing them in regards to what they stand for, God's plan, etc., is a type of curse upon the individual. And he gets the brunt of God's judgment. Really, I mean, it's pretty hard not to accept that fact considering what happened to Lot after the fact. To disregard, to look down upon one who is otherwise holding to the truth of doctrine in their lives. And for Abram and all of his descendants, those who engage in anti-Semitism and things of this nature, even though the Jews may be in unbelief, God's against them. See? So he ends up falling on that side of the coin. He embraced the world. He became an enemy of God. He came under God's curse. L, another one, and, quote, "he who is not with me is against me," end quote. I don't care what kind of lip service they may give and tell you how much they love you otherwise. They had no real interest in your spiritual well-being. Matthew 12:30. "He who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters," using an agricultural metaphor. Not united in regards to the truth of Bible doctrine. Operating on the side of doctrine. Well, whose side are you operating on then? If you're not in line with doctrine, who are you in line with? This funny mentality, you know, that is so pervasive in our time and period of history. You know, Most believers don't look at things in such concise ways in regards to others and relationships. If they've rebelled against Bible doctrine, they've blown out a Bible class, they disregard doctrine, they're not for you, they're not with you. And as we brought out in regards to Lot and Abraham, generally you'll always find another agenda that's part of their reason why they want to hang with you. Whatever it may be. But it's not for the spiritual edification, truly. See. And finally, probably couldn't put enough of them in here, but many who are first shall be last. Well, that's a really good one for this one. Lot, take your pick. Any area you want. I'll take the Jordan Valley. It's the best. I'm first in this deal. Well, he may be first physically in regards to his, what you may see in the world of his advantage and prosperity, etc. But he's last in regards to the list of God, of who God blesses forever and ever. See, in that sense. Matthew 19:30 brings out this principle. Let people go out and go for what they want to go for. Just let them do it. We'll see how it all shakes out at the Bema Seat. Here in regards to the promise of blessings, for those who are willing to align themselves with Bible doctrine, Jesus Christ, what sacrifice we may have to make, and you never know what God may call upon for us in regards to sacrifice. You see this happen. People make great sacrifices, and they apply beautifully often in these areas. But this does not go unnoticed by God. God sees all this, and these are targets for those who are apologists, especially of great blessing by God. Jesus said to them, as they, as Christ's disciples, we've left everything and followed you. Oh, big deal. Who wouldn't, if it was a mountain of gold out there? My family, see your friends, you can have whatever I got. I'm going after this. But anyway, how people's attitudes are sometimes. Not to diminish, again, sacrifices as they are. And they have. They gave up their livelihoods, cosmically speaking, and things of this nature. What then will there be for us? And Jesus said to them, truly I say to you, that you who have followed me, that's your caveat, in the regeneration, that's the millennial period, technically, when the Son of Man will sit on His glorious throne, you also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. This obviously in anticipation of their positive volition. He gives them a little perk. To endure now, and be patient. The blessings will come. And then verse 29, for phase 2 blessing, and everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or farms for my sake, namesake, his reputation, the truth of doctrine, whatever one may sacrifice in terms of economy, business, relationships, things of this nature, shall receive many times as much, and inherit, and in addition, shall inherit eternal life. Doesn't mean that it's not going to be without the testing. Sometimes it will be a while to prove your mettle. See. You're committed. But the promise is there. And if you're willing to faith rest, put it in God's hands, maintain your fidelity to doctrine, rather than jumping the gun, getting out of your SCA, abandoning doctrine for your own frantic search of happiness otherwise. Well, all these have repercussions in regards to the decisions we make, but many who are first will be last, and the last first. Those who are humble looking to God in all that they do in their life and pursue, they will be exalted at the right time. Let the exaltation, let the blessing come from God at His perfect timing. Trust me, timing has a lot to do in regards to our capacity to enjoy the blessings that God gives us. What one may receive at a young age, they would have a better capacity, being more mature and responsible to enjoy what they have. Kids, teenagers, and cars, that's a good example. You're a teenager, living in my generation, go on, buy me a vet, you know. You hit it, you kill yourself. But anyway, yeah, I wouldn't have appreciated it. I would have had appreciation. I'm not saying you wouldn't. But compared to being older and mature, I guarantee you I would have trashed it. So, you know, you get the idea. And it's not the greatest example, but you get the idea. To hang in there, let God exalt you. Let the cosmos go after, pursue what they want to pursue now, have it now, like this is the only time to ever live. Look back at you and say, look how we're passing you by, or whatever. When it comes down to it, they'll be at the end of the line. At the reward ceremony, if you will, so to speak, in regards to everlasting blessing. And again, most often, the capacity to enjoy the blessing. There are people out there that are multi-billionaires, got all the money in the world, and they don't have the capacity to enjoy it. Now, if anything sucks, that sucketh. See? To have something that cool and yet doesn't mean anything to you. I mean, in that sense. And obviously, you go through tests, and when God does bless you, your new blessing, you just have this capacity to enjoy it even more. Take my word for it. If you're young, if you're old, you know what I'm talking about. By old, I mean mature. Not older than me or whatever. You don't have to be a grandpa to understand it. Well, today is Father's Day, isn't it? Well, we give thanks to our Heavenly Father. We'll honor Him every day of the year. There you go. We call Him Abba, Daddy. In Abraham's generosity towards his nephew, and allowing him to pick the best of the land for himself, is widely recognized now as being a model for his descendants to imitate. The extension of grace and this whole principle of waiting upon God, letting God bless you, that was to be a model for his descendants, the Jews, the Hebrews, to follow in their representation as a custodial of God's plan in the age of Israel, etc. See, we can look at it, we can expand it even to spiritual descendants in the church age. But overall, this is to be a model for polyvolition, if you will, to imitate. It is at least suggested in the narrative, as I brought out, that the homosexual population associated with Sodom and Gomorrah were of the Perizzites. Parasites. This is a Z. Even though I may not have said it. That's verse 7. I brought that out. Obviously, Canaanites, where do they live? In Canaan. That's their predominant habitat. Well, where are these parasites? Are they also co-inhabitants? Well, they might have been somewhat mixed. But they would be predominantly the opposite of where Abraham was at. Otherwise, that's where Lot went. So P, that's my logic behind it. P, the reaffirming of covenant blessing upon Abraham, recognizes his final application, fulfilling the preconditions. Verse 14a, the Lord said to Abraham, after Lot has separated from him. So that reaffirmation gives due recognition to Abraham. You've applied the conditions and terms I set forth for you in application of the doctrine. And if there's anyone that needs to represent the application of separation, who else would it be in history than Abraham, who is going to bring about out of his line the Messiah who separates the entirety of mankind? See? So a reason why he was probably picked in part spiritually to represent this in regards to his person on such a high level. It's one that the fundies just basically gloss over. Separation. You know, they'll recognize, oh yeah, got evil people around him, the pagans, you know, and all this other stuff, but the rest of it usually lost on them. So the reaffirmation, the final affirmation, if you will, here in this chapter, recognizes Abraham's level of application. He is now applying at an acceptable level before Yahweh to bring about these blessings. His blessing by God then is contrasted to Lot's frantic search for happiness, as we brought out in the previous analysis point. Lot's pursuit, limited, temporal, big time, and end result is anything less than desirable. Abraham's blessing is without limit, essentially. Six, Lot's direction of life as a reversionist was limited and destined for destruction, verse 10. He picked the Valley of Jordan. This was before the Lord purposed to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, literally. Begins with S, I guess. Abraham's blessing was universal, verse 14b, northeast, south, west, and to be everlasting, verse 15, give you the land forever. T, that the land will be Israel's eternal possession, is then reaffirmed in Genesis 17:8 and 48:4, and further as a presupposition of the Jubilee legislation, time of celebration, if you will, and rest, and the inheritance laws, the Mosaic Law, Genesis 17:8. God reaffirms that I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. We'll see it again in 48:4. Here, as it then pertains to Jacob, offspring of Abraham. And he said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a company of peoples, and will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. It just goes right down the line through positive volition. And then the presupposition is presupposed in regards to Jubilee legislation, Leviticus 25 through 34. verse 23, the land, moreover, should not be sold permanently. For the land is mine. One of those things. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. All the emphasis that God puts on this real estate. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor, he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold, to bail him out, to ensure that they continue to have the right of possession. Or in a case a man has no kin, that so recovers his mean as to find sufficient for his redemption, and he shall calculate the years since his sale and refund the balance of the man to whom he sold it, and so return to his property. In other words, real estate is not ever to be taken on a permanent basis away from somebody. There is a way to regain possession, and this looks to grace, etc., all these things that are associated with it. Then he shall, and even if he doesn't have a kinsman, and he comes to the building, the bank's got to give it back. See, that's what way you'd look at it today. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back, verse 28, for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of his purchaser until the year of Jubilee. The 49th cycle of 7 years sabbaticals. But at the Jubilee it shall revert, that he may return to his property. Depends on kind of where you fell on this thing. You may have to sit there, and you lost it when you was young, and Jubilee doesn't come around until you close to 80, and it comes back. Or you may just lost it, 3 years prior, but it reverts back on the year of Jubilee. That's your line, see. It's kind of like pictures when God's in control, see, of this whole thing. And it's based on God's will, not man's. But anyway. Verse 29, likewise, if man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, an urbanite, then his redemption right remains valid until a full year from his sale. His right of redemption lasts a full year. But if it's not brought back for him within the space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city passes permanently to his purchaser throughout its generation. It does not revert in the Jubilee. So you have a difference between people living in the city and people that are living outside suburbia, farming, and things of this nature. And I'm not here to try to explain all that, because I don't understand it all at this point in time. The houses of the villages, however, which had no surrounding, verse 31, wall shall be considered as open fields. They have redemption rights and revert in the Jubilee to be redeemed. It probably all has spiritual pictures and significance. As for the cities of the Levites, the Levites have a permanent right of redemption for the houses of the cities which are their possession. They are excluded in regards to that clause if they live in the city. Why? Because the Levites were not given any of the real estate of the 12 tribes. Because it is their job to be among all the tribes to teach them doctrine. See, they're supposed to be their spiritual leaders, so to speak, in that regard. So, anyway. Verse 33, what therefore belongs to the Levites may be redeemed, the house sale in the city of possession reversed in the Jubilee. For the house of the city of the Levites are their possession among the sons of Israel. Where else are they going to live? They don't have a right to own land, if you will, as acreages, things of that nature. But pasture fields of their city shall not be sold, for that is their perpetual possession. Always have their living grace available, basically, is the idea there. Then Numbers 36. Here. Just some interesting things to see in regards to the importance that God attaches to the land. 3 through 9, Numbers 36, under inheritance by marriage. That if they marry one of the sons of the other tribes, the sons of Israel, their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of our fathers would be added to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. This will be withdrawn from our allotted inheritance in regards to families intermarrying, tribes among tribes. If a female marries into the deal or goes to another tribe in that regards, whatever right and inheritance they have reverts to that tribe in general. And when the Jubilee of the sons of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added, verse 4, to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. So their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers. Then Moses commanded the sons of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying the tribes of the sons of Joseph are right in their statements. This is what the Lord has commanded concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them marry whom they wish, only they must marry within the family of the tribe of their father. Thus no inheritance of the sons of Israel shall be transferred from tribe to tribe. For the sons of Israel shall each hold to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who comes into the possession of the inheritance of any tribe, the sons of Israel shall be wife to one of the family of the tribe of her father, so that the sons of Israel may, each may possess the inheritance of his fathers. Is kept in perpetuity, basically. Thus no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another, for the tribes of the sons of Israel shall each hold to his own inheritance. That's the way God divided it out. Anyway. And a lot of that has to do with their forefathers and whether they were positive and what they accomplished and things of this nature, not to get into all that. All right, you. Now, the God-given nature of this land is a central theme of Deuteronomy and the basis for prophetic hope that Israel will return there after the exile. So, again, the scope, magnitude of its importance, Deuteronomy 3:18-21. Then I commanded you at that time, saying, the Lord your God has given you the land, this land to possess it. All you valiant men will cross over armed before your brothers and sons of Israel. But your wives and your little ones, your livestock, I know that you have much livestock, shall remain in your cities which I have given you. So the Lord gives rest to your fellow countrymen as to you. And they also possess the land which the Lord your God will give them beyond the Jordan. So it's all about the land, obviously, under the conquest generation, etc., etc. Then you may return every man to his possession which I have given you. But you've got to sacrifice at home until that's occurred. And you just do it. Verse 21, and I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, your eyes have seen all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. The Lord shall do to all the kings to which you are about to cross as they went in to inherit. And then 33-5. So, again, the Exodus did not get to enjoy that blessing. The conquest did to own real estate, especially this particular piece of real estate. 33-5. Then the Lord your God will restore you from captivity and have compassion on you, and will gather you again from all the peoples from where the Lord your God has scattered you. Under fifth cycle discipline, they were dispersed, kicked out of the land. Under reversion and recovery, then they're restored back into the land. See, it's all about being in or out of the land, whether you possess it or not. If you're outcast or at the end of the earth, verse 4, from there the Lord your God will bring you, and from there he will bring you back. And the Lord your God will bring you to the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it, and he will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers. So the promise of perpetuity, obviously through divine discipline, national discipline, they may lose their rights of possession temporarily. But it's always an anticipation, a positive volition that comes from the Hebrew race, the Jews, etc., as that is connected to possession and occupying the land, then as we understand and see them today, being back in the land, Jeremiah 31:2-21, in regards to the prophetic hope of returning back to the land, you can read those verses on your own. Abram's heritage here is magnified beyond the scope of man's ability to even comprehend. That's verse 16. You can count the dust of the earth and you can count your descendants. that you have the unaccountability then of Abraham's descendants is a perennial theme of Genesis, as the covenant becomes, if you will, for all intents and purposes from this point on, completely and totally unconditional. See, that's what we're saying here. Genesis 15:5, not that they're not accountable in regards to volition, but for to possess land, to be the rightful inheritors of it. 16:10, 28:14, 32:12. And here, the number of people in and of themselves, how many people they had, that's actually what we're dealing with here. Balaam found the Hebrews already beyond counting. In his day, there were so many people. They reproduced exponentially in a very big way and quickly. By the time of Balaam, you didn't know how many Jews have actually had lived or around. Numbers 23:10. You're dealing with the dust of the earth. Who can count the dust of Jacob, or number the fourth part of Israel? God's promise obviously took hold very quick in history in this respect. Why Solomon said the same thing centuries later, 1 Kings 3:8. Z, an application of separation. Abram entered into a new state of blessing and spiritual stability. That's verses 17 and 18. Finishing out the chapter. 37, end of chapter, or Fay in the text, is recognized by the Hebrew scribes. And then a new setting is introduced in chapter 14, as we will begin it Tuesday evening. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to light to see things in Jesus' name. Amen.